We now move into the chapter on free consent. Consent. When two parties agree on the same thing in the same sense and there is consensus ad idem, we say there is consent. However, if there is a major error in consensus, there is deemed to be a mistake or an error in understanding. Provided there is consensus or provided there is consent, sometimes it may not be freely or voluntarily given. And therefore, this chapter talks about what exactly is free consent. Section 14, consent is said to be free when it is not caused by coercion as defined in section 15, undue influence as defined in section 16, wherein the agreement is voidable, fraud as defined in section 17, misrepresentation under 18, and mistake as defined in sections 20 to 22, which makes the agreement void. Well, my dear friends, to just give you a background of this topic, when consent is not free or wherein it is not given voluntarily by the person in the presence of coercion, which means a physical threat, undue influence, which is a kind of a moral pressure, misrepresentation, which means a false statement made innocently, or in the event of fraud, a false statement made willfully or intentionally. In the first four cases, the agreement is sought to be set aside by the aggrieved or injured party, is understood as a voidable agreement in the presence of the absence of free consent. On the other hand, when there is an error on the very subject matter as far as quality, quantity, price structure or the existence is concerned and the base of the subject matter goes flat, we say here is an error which is called as a mistake which renders the agreement void ab initio. Coercion. Section 15. Any act which is committed, which is forbidden by IPC, that is the Indian Penal Code, or the threat to commit an act forbidden by IPC, is coercion. It also includes an unlawful detention of any property or the threat to detain any property of another. Friends, in England or in English law, this is called duress. D-U-R-E-S-S. Now, the difference between coercion and duress is that duress only talks about the person of another, wherein it is a physical threat by one unto another. It excludes property. However, we in India include both the physical aspect as well as the threat to property. And therefore, coercion includes a threat by one person unto another as well as the detention or the threat to detain the property of another. Whereas in duress under English law, the threat to property is completely excluded. It is necessary to understand the important ingredients of coercion. This is an act amounting to coercion which is done with the intention of causing any person to enter into an agreement. It does not matter whether IPC is or is not prevalent at the place where coercion is employed. A threat to file a suit obviously is not coercion, so that even if a person threatens that he is going to file a suit, it does not tantamount to any kind of a physicality by one person unto another. Well, what is the effect of coercion? It makes the contract voidable at the option of the party whose consent is so obtained. And therefore, A tells B, if you do not sell this property unto me, I will knock down C, your son. Now, this is called coercion. Here is a threat undertaken by A unto B so that B is now in a position to be at the level of an injured party who is in a position to avoid the contract is called aggrieved, so that he is in a position to set aside or make the contract voidable at his end is the essence of Section 15, coercion. We now move to undue influence. Here is the relation between persons where one is in a position to hold a real or apparent authority over the other. Example, a relationship between master and servant, a police officer and an accused. He stands in a fiduciary relation to the other, where it is a relation of mutual trust and confidence, doctor and patient, trustee and beneficiary, so that the essence of undue influence, friends, you will now know, here is a relation between two people. What is the difference between coercion and undue? Coercion is physical threat. Undue is a moral pressure by a stronger man over the weaker person. How do you decide the stronger versus the weaker? We have three parameters here. One is a real or apparent authority. Here is an official position whereby the employer unto the employee, the master unto the servant, the police officer versus the accused. Here is a position of a real or apparent authority exercised by one over the other. Second is a case of a fiduciary relationship whereby one reposes trust or confidence in another and therefore goes blindly by whatever the other person dictates. So that here is a relationship between a doctor and a patient, an advocate versus a client, a father versus obviously the son or the mother and the daughter. These are fiduciary relationships. Finally, old age or any kind of a mental illness by an old person, or where the mental capacity of a person is temporarily disturbed, he seeks the advice or guidance of a medical attendant and the medical attendant takes undue advantage. Here is a stronger person who is taking advantage over the weaker person is a case of undue influence. In all these cases, obviously, the aggrieved party is entitled to set aside the contract. Well, friends, what is the main point of difference between coercion and undue? Section 15 states it's a physical force punishable under IPC, whereas Section 16, it is an act based upon the use of moral force, which is not punishable under IPC. Coercion, it can even be entertained by a stranger to the contract. As I just had it illustrated, A tells B, I will knock down your son C if you don't sell the property to me. So C is a stranger, wherein the son is not a party to the contract at all. And here A exercises this coercion or the threat unto B is an act of physical force. Undue influence can be only between the parties to the contract. Is there any relationship of the parties? Need not be. Here, in undue influence, there is a fiduciary relationship between the parties. The dominance of one party? No, not necessarily. Whereas in undue influence, yes, there is a dominance by the stronger party or the dominant party over the weaker party. Onus, what is the proof? The aggrieved party has to prove coercion. The aggrieved party has to prove where exactly is the fiduciary relationship between the parties. Is there a punishment? It is punishable under IPC. It is not punishable under IPC. Fraud. It is an intentional, deliberate or willful misstatement of facts which are material for the formation of a contract. Section 17 says, it means and includes any of the following acts committed by a party to a contract or with his connivance. Connivance means the consent of a party either by himself or he has it carried on through an agent, is any kind of consensus to an unlawful or an illegal act is called as a connivance, or by his agent with an intent to deceive another party thereto, or his agent, or to induce him to enter into a contract. So fraud, in short, essentially means, my friends, here is a false statement made by a person who knows it is false or is a deliberate act which is done with a clear intention to deceive the opposite person or the other party. Whereas in misrepresentation, which will be followed very shortly, here is a false statement which is done innocently without an intention to deceive. What includes fraud? It is a suggestion as to a fact of that which is not true by one who does not believe it to be true. The prospectus of a company is issued to a shareholder. The prospectus states the company obviously is extremely prosperous and has a lot of growth, and the assets or the financial position is very sound. Unfortunately, it is not true, so that the losses are heavy, which has not been mentioned in the prospectus. This is the suggestion of a fact which is untrue by people who are aware, namely the board of directors or the promoters of the company, as well as the experts, are aware that the statement is untrue, is a fraudulent area, which is called the suggestion of a fact. The active concealment of a fact by one having knowledge or belief of the fact. The person is selling a furniture, right? We have Concepts Furniture, right? He sells a dining table. He's aware that there is a crack in the table and he doesn't mention this to the customer. This is an active concealment. That is to hide facts knowingly when you know it is wrong and you still proceed is a fraudulent act. A promise made without an intention of performing it. The debtor tells the creditor, well, I'll just pay you back the money very shortly, but he has no intention to pay it off, is such an act. Any act fitted to deceive or any act or omission as law specifically declares it to be fraudulent. Now, as far as any transfer of property or any acts as regards the company are concerned, here is an act whereby you're required under legal provisions to be revealing facts correctly and to obviously to be sound and stating the facts to the utmost which are true as far as facts are concerned. When law says that it has to be correctly stated, if it is not correctly stated and there is an omission by the company's promoters or the directors of the company, here is an act which law declares fraudulent. So therefore, whether it is the Transfer of Property Act, whether it is the Negotiable Instruments Act or any kind of act where law makes it mandatory, here is a provision which tantamounts to fraudulent act which is required under statutory provisions. Essentials of fraud: making a false suggestion as to a fact, an act of concealment of a fact, a promise made without an intention to perform, any other act fitted to deceive, any such act or omission as law specifically declares to be fraudulent, any failure to disclose material facts of immovable property to the buyer, or any representation of a fact to deceive. Here, the injured party, when he suffers a loss, is said to be the person who is in a position to be avoiding the contract in the capacity of an aggrieved party. When is a contract not voidable? That is, when is the injured party not in a position to avoid? A deceit which does not deceive is no fraud. The opposite man is aware that he is not fooled. He is not deceived. Is it fraud? No, it is not fraud. A party knowingly enters into an agreement when he knows that the other party is making a false representation. A tells B, my field is very fertile. It produces 20 quintals of rice. B tells A, no, I'll come to your field and I will check out the facts. When he knows that it is not producing and still entertains the contract, here is a case where it is not fraudulent. Neglect is no fraud. When the opposite party is negligent and does not want to check out facts, or ignorance, here, when he is not interested in not knowing the correct state of affairs, ignorance is no fraud at all. Silence is no fraud unless it is the duty of the person remaining silent to speak. We now move to misrepresentation. It is a positive assertion in a manner not warranted by the information of the person making it of that which is not true, though he believes it to be true. Well, what does this first aspect say? It says, A tells B, my horse runs very fast and obviously has an excellent speed. Here is a positive assertion. Or let me go to an earlier example where A told B, my field is very fertile, it produces 25 quintals of rice. Here is a positive assertion made by A, not warranted by the circumstances. Did A check out the facts? No, he has not checked. So here is a positive statement which is done unknowingly by A unto B. Here is a misrepresentation, which means this is a false statement which is done unknowingly. Any breach of duty which without an intent to deceive gains an advantage to the person committing it or anyone claiming under him by misleading another to his prejudice or to the prejudice of anyone claiming under him. Well, friends, what does this mean? To give you a very simple illustration, I have an insurance company and I have the insured. Under the insurance law, the insurance company has asked the insured person or the probable person who is wanting to take the policy, kindly reveal the state of your health. Now here, the person is required to state 5 facts. He states 4 facts, but as far as a point is concerned, do you suffer from severe diabetes or any other ailment? Now here, the insured person leaves that blank and does not mention. Now there are 2 possibilities. He has not checked out himself, or he's actually not aware whether he's a diabetic or not, or whether he suffers from any other ailment. Now this would be a breach of duty. A breach means to break a promise. Now, when he does it unintentionally, this tantamounts to a misrepresentation. When he does this intentionally, it tantamounts to a fraud. But what happens here? As far as the company is concerned, this would be a very major area which decides on the premium, so that if the insured is not able to disclose these facts correctly, it would affect the premium as far as the company is concerned. So therefore, this facts not being disclosed by the insured tantamounts to a misrepresentation. Causing, however, innocently a party to an agreement to make a mistake as to the substance of the thing which is the subject matter of the agreement. Here we have a famous case of Oceanic Steam Navigation Company versus Sundardas Dharamse. B wanted to take a ship from A and told him, I would like to have a tonnage of 4,500 tons. A told him, I don't think it would carry 4,500 tons. It would probably carry around 3,500. Now here was a false statement made by A when the capacity of the vessel was around 4,000, wherein it would have led to an economy as far as the transportation cost was concerned to B, but this was not mentioned correctly by A. So this is a major blunder which says it is a mistake as to the substance of the thing which is the subject matter of the agreement. Probably for the other party, namely B, it would have been a reduction in the transportation cost. But today, because of the tonnage not being up to the maximum capacity, he had to pay something more. Here is an agreement which can be avoided by B, wherein there has been a false representation by A. So, misrepresentation may occur in 3 cases, namely an unwarranted assertion, a breach of duty, or an innocent mistake. The effects of misrepresentation, the aggrieved party or the injured party can avoid or rescind the contract. He can accept the contract but insists that he shall be in the position in which he would have been if the misrepresentation had been true. Misrepresentation does not entitle the aggrieved party to claim damages. When misrepresentation does not avoid the contract, well, in, of course, he knowingly enters into the contract and accepts the same. Here is a case where he cannot have it avoided. So, friends, the major area of a difference between misrepresentation and fraud is that misrepresentation is any false statement which is done unknowingly, whereas fraud is a false statement made knowingly. Here, in misrepresentation, there is no intention to deceive, whereas in fraud, it is done knowingly with a clear intention that the aggrieved party is here to be deceived or to be cheated. In the case of fraud, you can claim damages, whereas in misrepresentation, there are no damages to be claimed. Finally, we have mistake, which renders the agreement void. Mistake means an error in the very base of the subject matter. Mistake are of two kinds, of law and of fact. Can there be a mistake as to the law of the country? Now, as far as mistake of law is concerned, we have the law of the land and we have the foreign law. Law of the land: ignorantia juris non excusat. An ignorance of Indian law is no excuse. Today, we have an Adivasi from a tribal area taking a transport. The Adivasi says, I thought I don't have to take a ticket because obviously in my village or in the rural area, I traveled from one place to another without a ticket. Comes to the urban area and says, fine, I thought I didn't have to take the ticket. Can he be sued? Yes, he can be, because ignorance of Indian law is no excuse, and each one of us is required to know the law of the land. Of course, as foreign law is concerned, here is one which is regarded void because a person is not required to know the law of the foreign country. Now, coming to mistake of fact, a mistake of fact is of two kinds: a bilateral mistake. What is a bilateral mistake? A mistake made by two parties simultaneously who are not aware of an error, which could be with regard to the subject matter, as regards its existence, the identity, the quality, the quantity, the price or title, is regarded void. To give you an illustration, Couturier versus Hasty is a case law on this point, where A and B entered into a contract for a shipment which was to arrive from England to Bombay. The agreement was already entered into or was about to be entered. At this point of time, the ship or the vessel had a major danger or peril at sea, and all the goods were washed out in the waters. Neither A nor B were aware of the destruction of the subject matter at the inception of the contract. This tantamounts to a mistake, which is called as a bilateral mistake as to the subject matter. Similarly, we have possibility of performance. We are aware that possibility has two kinds. One is an impossibility at the very beginning, and an impossibility which is called supervening impossibility, which may take place later on after the formation of the contract. When it is impossible to perform after it is entered, it is called as a void contract, and therefore it cannot be entertained because it becomes impossible to perform subsequently. As far as unilateral mistakes are concerned, it is perfectly valid unless it is as regards the nature of the transaction or the identity of the person, wherein it is regarded void. Otherwise, all unilateral mistakes are considered valid in law. Thank you very much. I think we've understood the area as regards free consent, wherein in the first four cases of coercion, undue fraud and misrepresentation, it is voidable, whereas in the last case of a mistake, it is considered void from sections 20 to 22 of the Indian Contract Act. Thank you very much.